This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talked to Labour Party member Colin Robinson from London and Doug Henwood from Brooklyn on the British elections and their implications for the Sanders campaign and the 2020 election in the United States.
We talked to the two editors of the new book, In Defense of Julian Assange.
It's no exaggeration to say that if the United States government under Trump drags him out of his prison cell in London and tries and convicts him of conspiracy in a Virginia court and gets him convicted as being a spy, it's a threat to world investigative journalism.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
On December 12, British Conservative Party leader Boris Johnson won the election over Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party by 43.6% to 32%. British voters were less moved by Corbyn's economic and social programs than they were by Johnson's nationalist positions, particularly by his promise to get Brexit done and pull Great Britain out of the European Union. This promised exit, known as Brexit, gave Johnson's nationalism a major boost. Brexit became the central issue of the campaign. It was looked upon by many voters as a blow to the system. Former Labour Party voters, particularly in the deindustrialized Rust Belt of England's north, which had been Labour's historic base, voted Conservative, hoping that Boris Johnson would shake things up. The Labour Party's program, which put forward the idea of a working-class party that taxes the rich to pay for redistribution and public services, was novel and attracted young people, but not enough to overcome Boris Johnson's appeal. There are many parallels between Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, and between Donald Trump and Boris Johnson. We speak today with Colin Robinson in London. He's a longtime member of the Labour Party and splits his time between England and New York, where he is a journalist and the co-publisher of Orr Books. Then we speak with economist Doug Henwood at his office in Brooklyn. Henwood is an economic analyst, a financial trader, and a journalist. His recent book, My Turn, analyzed the Hillary Clinton campaign of 2016. His recent article in Jacobin magazine is titled, Why Impeachment is a Waste of Time. Colin, it's good to have you back on Law and Disorder. Let's start off talking about the Labour Party and what it stood for, specifically about climate change, preserving the National Health Service, corporate power, austerity, public ownership of rail, funding for education and housing, corporate regulations that are going to be cut, and pay raises for millions. Who supported the Labour Party? And talk about its positions and what it tried to do.
Well, the Labour Party is a social democratic party. It's not a revolutionary party or even a really radical socialist party. It's broadly social democratic, and the demands that it was putting forward were demands that are actually quite commonplace in terms of being implemented across Europe. But British society's moved a long way to the right since the end of the Second World War, when there was a very good welfare state set up there. Successive Tory governments and the Blair government eroded those provisions, and Labour was really proposing to put them back in place. So it had a what it called a green industrial revolution in its programme. It had nationalisation of rail and some of the utilities, and the post office, renationalisation of those services. It had a £10 minimum wage, and building 100,000 council houses a year, public provision of housing. A solid social democratic programme, which built on the manifesto which it put out in the 2017 election, which was very popular.
When George W. Bush was elected for the second time, the headlines in one British newspaper declared, "How can 60 million Americans be so dumb?" Please allow me to ask you the same question, Colin. What about 43.6% of the British voters who voted for Boris Johnson? Why did the Labour Party lose a lot of its base? They had contrasting visions of society. Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell told the BBC that Brexit has determined the election. He said that we thought other issues would cut through and there would be a wider debate, but there wasn't, was there?
No, I think there was a debate about the NHS in the closing days of the campaign because there was a strong feeling on the part of the Labour Party, and I think shared by many people in the country, that if Johnson won the election as he has, then the NHS was vulnerable to the being taken over by big American healthcare providers. In fact, Donald Trump admitted as much when he said that everything was on the table, including the NHS, in forthcoming trade talks if Britain left the European Union. But the difficulty was that the Labour Party was split between people who were supporting Brexit and people who supported Remain. So a large percentage of its members, 70%, between 70 and 80% of its members, didn't want to leave the EU at all. And especially that group included a lot of young people who've been very active at the base of the party. This is now the largest party, political party in Europe with 500,000 members. So those people were all pretty committed to not leaving the EU, seeing it as a chauvinist act to Brexit. But Labour's working class base up in the north of England, especially in the northeast and in the Midlands, was very much in favour of Brexit, or at least a lot of people there were voting for Brexit. And they were doing that largely because they had concerns about immigration, but also because they really wanted to say that they were fed up to a southern elite in the country that was supporting Remain. It was their way of showing that they were really dissatisfied with how things in Britain were going, for good reason. I mean, the old industries in the north and the Midlands disappeared and weren't really replaced by anything. So those communities have really been through a hard time under successive Labour and Conservative governments in the last 40 years. You know, the miners' strike closed all the pits. They haven't really been replaced by anything. The steel industry disappeared. Shipbuilding is not what it was. So that kind of industrial base that traditionally supported Labour, was many of them were supporting Brexit. So Labour had to try and come up with a policy which was capable of keeping those two groups together. That was extremely difficult. They came up with a position that they were going to have a second referendum within 6 months of being elected. And in that referendum, they would put forward a proposal for staying in the EU. They put forward a position where they were going to leave the EU with workers' rights and environmental rights being protected, or stay in. That was a complicated decision, position to try and get over to the electorate. Corbyn himself said that he would be neutral in that referendum. I think people felt that they were just all over the place on that, and it didn't do well against a Tory line that was, we have to get Brexit done, which seemed very simple and clear, even though in reality it's not going to turn out like that.
Yeah, I know. Somebody commented that it's like a turkey voting for Thanksgiving. I mean, what do you think that Brexit will do to the working classes and middle classes in Great Britain?
Well, you know, I supported Brexit early on, and I think a lot of people on the left did, because it's not as though the European Union is a particularly progressive institution. If you look at what it did to, say, the big movements, the big radical movements that occurred in Spain and in Greece, And it imposed the most incredible banker-driven austerity on those countries. You know, it's really an institution, in my view, that is set up first and foremost to serve business, not to serve the needs of people. And I also think that there's a kind of, it's a traducing of internationalism to identify membership of the EU with some kind of internationalist perspective, because the EU really ceases to be an institution where the population ceases to be either Christian or rich or white. Many thousands of people have died in the Mediterranean this year trying to get into the EU and being forced back. So I don't regard it as a particularly progressive institution. On the other hand, a Brexit which is run by the right, which is what's happening now, and maybe was always going to happen, and why perhaps those of us who supported Brexit on the left made a tactical mistake, is not going to be good for working people in Britain. It's going to allow the United States to do the kind of trade deal with Britain that it has with Canada and Mexico, where it calls all of the shots and where regulations are just thrown onto a bonfire, regulations concerning workers' rights or the environment. American companies are going to be given free rein to come in and privatize the NHS and other British public services. So I think the future outside of the EU under a Johnson government is going to be pretty awful.
Let's talk about what the Labour Party was up against, the power of the British capitalist class and the power of the mainstream media.
Yeah, that was really, I think, a major factor in this election. If you look at the opinion polls, and it's hard to know how accurate these are, but they showed that the first reason people did not vote Labour or switch their votes away from Labour, I think it was about 3 million people who switched from the last election to this one, about a million and a bit to the Conservatives, and then rather more than that to other parties like the Liberal Democrats and the Greens. The main reason that they gave for doing that was because of they felt that Jeremy Corbyn was not a good leader. And Corbyn is not a conventional leader in the sense that he's not terribly charismatic, he's not a particularly eloquent speaker, but he is a man of extraordinary principle. You know, he's stuck to what he believes throughout his long political life. And on most of the big issues of the day, I mean, things like the Iraq War or the crash of 2008, history proved him to be completely right. I don't think there's any doubting his honesty, his integrity. So you have to say, well, why did so many people cite his leadership as the issue for them not voting Labour? And I think the reason for that overwhelmingly was that the media, over a long period of time, absolutely savaged him. I've never seen anything like the level of hostility expressed towards a politician as was directed at Jeremy Corbyn. You know, he was successively presented as being a, you know, wild far leftist, a communist, which he certainly isn't, of consorting with terrorism, the IRA, Hezbollah, Hamas, which certainly talked with those people, trying to bring them into the political process. But that's a long way from supporting them, which is how it's been presented, being called too old, that he's ill, that he's intolerant, that he's grouchy. It's just day after day of this across the British media, including on the BBC, which is a public service and is supposed to be paid for by the public's license fees. It's supposed to be neutral, but it wasn't. This really, over a period of time, even though people learn to be skeptical about the media, and they're probably more skeptical about it now than they ever have been, it has an effect. It wears people down and kind of frames what they think of a politician. I think Jeremy paid a terrible price for that. It's really been tragic to see the way that he's been treated by the media. And social media, I think, countered that to some degree. But I think in 2017, the left definitely had an edge in social media. They were more adept at it. and they had a bigger network of people who were able to use it. But I think the problem for the left going forward, and this is as true in the United States as it is in the UK, is that I think the right are now learning how to use social media, and of course they have huge resources. So I think that is what a media strategy which is capable of countering this sort of hostility from the right, from the state, is going to be in the future for the left is something that really needs to be talked about, because I don't know what it should be at this point in time.
Colin Robinson, it's been a real pleasure to get your analysis from London. We appreciate your being on Law and Disorder, and we'll check in with you later to see how things are developing. In the meantime, thanks for being on the program, and you take it easy.
Thanks very much, Michael. I enjoyed talking with you.
We're now joined by Doug Henwood in his office in Brooklyn. Doug, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, good to be here.
Doug, what are the similarities in the conditions in the middle and working classes in England and in the United States?
Well, they're pretty similar. There's been years of austerity, although I think it's usually more explicitly called that in Britain than it is here, and you know, large parts of the landscape have really not recovered from the deindustrialization of the 70s and 80s. And there are, you know, enormous polarities by income class and race and geography. So all those things are similar. The U.S. Is more racially diverse, which it does change the picture somewhat. But there are broad similarities between the two countries, and their reliance on a finance-led elites and much of the population really either left behind or falling apart.
Talk about the political messages of Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, especially their appeal to nationalism.
Yeah, these are two guys who are different in many ways, but they do have a similar nationalist appeal, a nostalgia for a time when Britain or the U.S. was great. It's not clear what their point of reference is for that greatness, but it's just this vague nostalgia that people can project what they want to on. They're both skilled hucksters with really no core principles at all. They'll say whatever it takes to get them elected, but once in office, they will defer to the richest and most powerful and most malign forces in their society. And so there are great similarities between the two this kind of xenophobic nationalism they share as well. You know, Johnson, of course, has this old Etonian upper class demeanor, whereas Trump has this still unpolished, you know, Queens kind of rawness. But underneath those differences in style, there's an awful lot that they share in substance.
Yeah, I remember Spy magazine calling Trump a stubby-fingered vulgarian.
Short-fingered vulgarian and Queens-born casino operator, yeah.
Johnson is such a disheveled-looking guy, you wonder how he could come out of Eton. But let me ask you this. What programmatic parallels do you see between Jeremy Corbyn over there and Bernie Sanders and his supporters over here?
There's a lot of similarity, and certainly there's an awful lot of similarity in their most enthusiastic fan base, both appeal to the younger portion of the population. Sanders is generally politically more moderate than Corbyn. Corbyn really, you know, comes out of a pretty strong left tradition. A lot of his key advisors came out of various Trotskyist parties going back to a few decades. He has always been more anti-imperialist, more critical of Britain's colonial heritage, more explicitly pro-Palestinian, which is, you know, supposedly alienated centrist voters. I don't know. That's what the line is. Sanders is more careful about that stuff. His program, you know, is basically, by American standards, pretty radical, but, you know, by the standards of the world, it's pretty routine social democracy. Which seems pretty alien to most Americans. But, I think there's that if I had to put them on the spectrum, Corbyn at least presents as being to the left of Sanders, although their personal styles are very different. Corbyn seems like a much more understated, you know, vegetarian who doesn't get angry or raise his voice or wave his arms and Bernie is just more of an old-style, loudmouth, working-class Jewish guy from Brooklyn. And I think that might actually serve Sanders better than Corbyn. I think that, that gives him more charisma, more appeal. And you know, given the angry tone in much of politics today, I think Sanders is much more appropriate.
The mass media in England was against Corbyn. In the United States, the mainstream media has pretty much ignored Bernie Sanders, even though he's a leading candidate. How do you explain that?
Well, that's typically the way the American media operate, I guess. They try to ignore things that they find unpleasant. But, you know, Corbyn is the head of a major party, had a plausible chance to become prime minister. So I think the media in Britain were very alarmed and mobilized appropriately. I think we're now starting to see stories about we need to start taking Sanders seriously. He may not be leading in the polls, but he's been a solid second. He's got a solid base. He could surprise us all. And I've seen this from several points of the political spectrum over the last few days, just from right-wing kind of Wall Street sources to, you know, more mainstream sources to making this argument. We've also seen an uptick. It's not a torrent yet, but there is an uptick in the number of stories about Sanders and anti-Semitism. Now, of course, it'd be very hard to label Sanders himself an anti-Semite for obvious reasons, but I think the line they're going to take is that he tolerates anti-Semites like Linda Sarsour and Ilhan Omar, and I suspect we're going to see a lot of pressure on him to repudiate them and denounce them, and how he reacts to that will be really key to how a lot of things play out in the coming weeks.
Yeah, well, that kind of attack on Jeremy Corbyn, I think, was successful. Labeling him and the Labour Party anti-Semitic because of their support for Palestinians.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's successful. And from what I hear, the people behind it were very pleased with their work. And you get called a conspiracy theorist and an anti-Semite if you start talking this way, but it's absolutely true that these publicity campaigns are organized by the Israel lobby and coordinated often by Israeli government. They have people at the highest levels of the Israeli government running these sorts of things. They ran it against Julia Salazar in New York, and I think we're going to see something very similar here. It's going to be a relentless PR operation, and all you have to do is say the same thing over and over and over again, and people will start talking about it. So the question will become, well, maybe there's something here, you know, why does Bernie support these anti-Semites? And you know, instead of saying, what utter nonsense is this, and like, you know, who's responsible for spreading these lies, it just plants the suspicion and gets people talking about things that really are way off, you know, just way off track, and not at all harmonious with the issues that that Sanders is trying to raise. It could get very ugly and very distracting, and these people behind these sorts of campaigns have a lot of experience in it, and I just hope that Sanders has the nerve to denounce them instead of apologizing, because once you start apologizing, that's the end of it. Because you know, I despise Donald Trump, but you have to admire the way that that guy just will not apologize for anything. There's something to be learned in politics from that. If you apologize, you know, you're just giving too much to the enemy.
Yeah, well, he learned that from Roy Cohn. Let me ask about the British Labour Party as compared to the American Democratic Party. The British Labour Party's actual members. It has meetings, it collects dues, and its policies are determined by the votes of its membership. This is not true of the Democratic Party of the USA.
It's not. Yeah, it's really a shocker for an American.
Well, let me ask you this question. Do you see an American independent working class party on the horizon?
No. I have hope sometimes that DSA is one of those in formation. People I talk to in DSA, you know, often think of it that way, as some sort of, in a jargon of the trade, a pre-party formation. DSA now is using the Democratic ballot line, but most of the people I talk to in leadership positions, or people who think about these things seriously, don't want to merge the Democratic Party or Michael Harrington style try to take it over. I think they really just want to use the ballot line, because that's the only choice you have under American electoral law. It's like, this is virtually, the two-party system has a quasi-legal status in this country. It's really hard to work around. So if you run as a Democrat in the primary, the advantage of the fact that the Democratic Party is not a membership organization is that anybody can you know, if you meet the legal requirements, sign up and run in a Democratic primary. There's really nothing the party can do to stop you. They'll do their best to hamstring your operation, but, you know, they can't really stop you. Sanders ran as a Democrat, even though he was never won. And a number of DSA people have been running for local offices on the Democratic line, just using the ballot lines of convenience. This annoys a lot of Democrats, even pretty left-wing Democrats. A friend of mine who's identifies as a Democratic socialist who's pretty active in the California Democratic Party really gets annoyed with this attitude of this kind of use them and throw them away attitude that DSA people are developing towards the Democratic Party. But that's, I think that's it looks to me like a good strategy because, like I say, the two-party system has such a stranglehold over the legal machinery and the consciousness of just about everyone that it's really hard to get around that. So as much as I'd like to see an independent third party, it's just really almost doomed from the start here.
I think that the powers that be in the Democratic Party, the corporate powers, will not let Sanders get the nomination. I think that Trump will win the presidency again, and I think you probably agree with me. And what do you think this means for working class and middle class people here in the USA?
They're going to do everything they can to prevent Sanders from getting a nomination. And this, you know, this propaganda campaign, the anti-Semitism, they're going to find everything. They just look at these lunatics on Twitter going after him too. This he's a deadbeat dad, and, you know, just irresponsible. He never had a job till he was 40. He was a welfare parasite. The things that they're spreading about him, I think it's like a testing ground for what the bigger media and the official PR operation is going to try in the coming weeks. But, you know, it's funny. Trump was able to take on the entire Republican establishment. He knocked off Jeb Bush, who was, you know, the favorite, and one by one he knocked off, you know, all the challengers. There was much alarm in the leadership of the Republican Party, and they couldn't stop him. And then at first there was some reluctance among the congressional Republicans to sign on to the Trump operation. And now he totally dominates the party. He really took the whole thing over. And it'd be remarkable if Trump was able to do that with the Republican Party, but Sanders couldn't do that with the Democrats. Maybe the Democrat leadership has a much tighter control on the party machinery than the Republicans did, which is something worth thinking about. But yeah, I think you're right that they will do everything they can to prevent him getting the nomination. That would suggest to me that, you know, if they do the foolish thing of nominating Biden, I don't see how he could beat Trump. I don't see how any of the other candidates could beat Trump, really. And it's frightening to think about if we have four more years of this, you know, the savaging of the last remaining humane things the government does. Just today it was reported by Politico that that Trump cut half the Medicaid funding for Puerto Rico from about $12 billion to $6 billion in the coming year as part of the budget deal. And that's just going to be what we're going to see all over the place. Privatization of Social Security and Medicare. Now, just whatever remaining humane things the government does in income support or education will be savaged. The environment will be further despoiled. Labor law is already pretty awful. I don't know how you get much worse, but there would certainly be an intensified war on unions and labor. It would just be miserable. But the Democratic Party has made it clear that it's just absolutely unwilling to tolerate even a mild dose of social democracy of the sort that that Sanders is promoting. It really became clear in 2016, the mainstream of the Democratic Party always said, oh, we would like all these nice things, you know, like a good welfare state, but, you know, the Republicans stop us from doing it, so we can't do it. But it became clear during the Hillary-Sanders fight that they themselves don't want it. And so you had all these Democrats coming out saying, this is USA, we don't give things away for free, no free tuition, you know, no free health care. It's clear that the leadership of the Democratic Party and their funders can't tolerate even these modest and quite affordable programs that Sanders is running on. And the leadership of the Democratic Party, their strategy seems to be that things are okay until January 20th, 2017, when Trump took over. And if we could just go back to the Obama years, everything would be okay. You know, and certainly everything was not okay during the Obama years. And it's really hard to parse this correctly, because Trump is a turn for the worse, and things were bad. I mean, it's hard to believe those two things. It's hard to get those two things right, because there's an awful lot of mainstream Dems will not want to hear that things were bad before Trump, that everything bad has happened in the United States is a result of Trump. On the other hand, you have some people who don't want to admit that Trump is a turn for the worse. So I guess I'd have to say that, you know, it's a two-part formula.
On those grim words, Doug, I'm afraid we're going to have to say goodbye to you. We've run out of our allotted time. I would love it if you'd come back on Law and Disorder. You wrote a provocative piece in Jacobin Magazine on why you think impeachment is a waste of time, something I agree with you with, and maybe we can get you back on the show to talk about that. In the meantime, you take it easy, and thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Happy to talk to you anytime.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The Trump administration has asked that he be extradited to Virginia for trial as a spy. Today we interview Margaret Kunstler and Tariq Ali, who edited and introduced the just-published book In Defense of Julian Assange. The book demonstrates convincingly that what is at stake in his upcoming trial is the future of free journalism here and abroad. Julian faces a 175-year sentence under the century-old Espionage Act, passed during World War I to be used against spies. He is charged with conspiring with Chelsea Manning to publish the Iraq war logs, the Afghanistan war logs, and State Department cables. Former CIA director and current Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has called WikiLeaks a, quote, non-state intelligence service, close quote. Hillary Clinton wanted him assassinated by drone. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melzer, recently visited him in prison and concluded that indeed he was being tortured. When he last appeared in court, he was incoherent and couldn't remember his name or date of birth. WikiLeaks was launched by Julian Assange in 2006, 3 years after Bush and Cheney commenced the illegal, catastrophic war against Iraq in 2003. Julian is a computer genius. He invented a way for publishers like WikiLeaks to receive truth-telling information anonymously. The first bombshell he published in 2006 was the Iraq war logs. He got them from whistleblower Chelsea Manning, who was then in the military. They showed a video of American soldiers in a helicopter committing a war crime by gunning down and executing a number of Iraqi civilians, two Reuters journalists, and several children. Then they chuckled about it. The photo of the murders is shown on the book's cover. This leak, furnished by Chelsea Manning, was devastating to the United States. Other whistleblower leaks followed. The government became relentless in trying to close down WikiLeaks. Margaret Kunstler is a longtime civil rights attorney in New York City. Tariq Ali is a British socialist scholar and author. We are speaking to him in London. Margaret is in our New York City studio. Tariq and Margaret, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Very good to be with you again.
Julian Assange is in prison in London, waiting to be extradited to East Virginia for trial. Margaret, we want to talk about what the U.S. government is alleging he did. You chose to print the indictment in your book, and you've done criminal defense work your whole life. Talk about the indictment, and then, if you will, please explain the Espionage Act.
Well, the indictment is a 17-count indictment with charges under the Espionage Act, and one charge that's based on the Computer Fraud Act. The indictment itself is a violation of the First Amendment. The First Amendment, you know, it allows free speech, and the only limits on that is a clear and present danger. And what we have here is an alternative universe, which suddenly says that this is not free speech, this is espionage. Now, you can't have an espionage charge against a journalist or a publisher, because that is limiting free speech. So the entire indictment is illegal and a violation of the First Amendment. So that's the first step. The second step is, even under the Espionage Act, the charge of conspiracy fails, because Julian was not conspiring with Chelsea Manning. He was receiving information from Chelsea Manning, and therefore it was not a conspiracy. If you look at the indictment itself and read, forgetting about the charges themselves, and read the fact pattern, it comes from an alternative universe. Every fact pattern is a First Amendment protected activity. Julian, for example, speaks at an open forum and says, send me whatever you want to send me. Now that's totally a protected activity. Or Julian publishes a list that is called the Most Wanted List. That list is not authored by Julian, but by human rights attorneys all over the world who get together and sit in a room and say, what do we want? And so they're accusing Julian of putting that list up, and they're saying, oh, so he's asking for it. And asking for it makes it outside of the normal First Amendment protections. So the entire indictment is outrageous. It's a political charge. It violates the First Amendment, and it has really nothing to do with the laws of the United States, which have developed freely around the First Amendment and clearly have said that the only exception to the First Amendment is a clear and present danger.
Now, Margaret, what is his current legal situation?
He is currently denied bail on the espionage charge, and that is the only thing that is holding him in a maximum security prison under terrible circumstances.
Tariq, Mike Pompeo, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency and Trump's current Secretary of State, stated that Julian was not a journalist, but rather he was running a, quote, foreign intelligence service. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, my thoughts on this are that Pompeo uttering remarks like this is so absurd and borders on the edge of sanity. I mean, I honestly believe that he knows it's a lie, but he's saying it. But if he actually believes the stuff, he needs urgent medical attention because it's obvious to everyone what Julian is, what he did, and why he's being punished. I mean, you know, when a U.S. Army private, Chelsea then Bradley Manning, leaked hundreds of thousands of secret government documents relating to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2010 and exposing war crimes committed by the United States, they were immediately counterattacked by the right and by supporters of the wars, to whom Manning became enemy number one. She had to be punished, and the demands arose even then. Very soon after the WikiLeaks published these documents, that Julian should be extradited and dealt with in the United States. That's all he did. He published the documents, and then WikiLeaks' exposures, many of them, were published simultaneously by The Guardian in London, The New York Times in New York, El País in Madrid, and La Repubblica in Italy. Four liberal newspapers published this. So are they going to be charged as well? If not, why not? Why target Julian? He just made them available. So if the crime is publishing these things, he shouldn't be the only one in prison. In fact, no one should be in prison. But there's an inconsistency. To say that he's running an intelligence service.
The United States launched Operation Iraqi Liberation in 2003. And in 2010, WikiLeaks released the Iraq war logs and the Afghanistan war logs. What was the historical significance of that?
Well, what the war logs revealed was the truth. You know, what was going on in Iraq, why it had been invaded, including some archive material which shocked the world, which was the killing of Iraqi civilians in a random fashion. We saw helicopter attacks knocking out civilians. We saw the destruction of an Iraqi family simply because it was Iraqi on the road for a bit of fun. And it brought home the realities and truths of the war, which had not been revealed at that time by the mainstream media. So it did create a sensation and a great deal of anger, because lots of people, unfortunately, at that time, tend to believe Western propaganda as to why the war was being fought. And the revelation of why the war was really being fought to defend and protect U.S. hegemony in the region, to recolonize Iraq, and the behavior and the tortures being inflicted on the Iraqi people did create a storm. And that is what projected WikiLeaks and Julian to where they remain now, you know, as truth tellers and as people prepared to defy the world's mightiest army and armed forces and propaganda networks in order to bring the truth home. That's what they did. And that's why he's not been forgiven.
Margaret, can you talk about how Julian invented a way for whistleblowers to release information anonymously?
Yes. Julian developed this program where people who had information that they wanted to get to him could send him the information and remain totally anonymous. And there would be no way for Julian to know or anybody else to know who sent that information. And that was critically important because it protected the whistleblower. And this was the first program of this sort that totally protected the whistleblower. Subsequent to that, there were some other programs added, but they haven't worked as well.
And I'm sure for that invention, Julian didn't enamor himself to the government.
No, I'm sure he didn't.
What did WikiLeaks do to expose the Democratic National Committee's bias and machinations against Bernie Sanders in favor of Hillary Clinton?
I think WikiLeaks' exposure of the Clinton emails played a big part in liberal hatred for Julian Assange, and a total refusal by most liberals, mainstream liberals, to defend him. And I think there's very little doubt that it was the WikiLeaks exposure that inspired Edward Snowden, a private analyst then at the NSA, to expose the staggering extent of its illegal surveillance of U.S. citizens and foreigners, including staunch U.S. allies like the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. So the extent of what the NSA was up to, which was not revealed by WikiLeaks, but actually probably inspired Edward Snowden to do what was required. I mean, Edward had no radical background whatsoever, but was just angered by what he found out when he heard the NSA bosses testifying before the Senate and saying that they did not conduct illegal surveillance of U.S. citizens, which was a total lie, and Snowden knew it. So both Snowden and other whistleblowers in different parts of the world, and more whistleblowers to come, will without any doubt be inspired by that. And I think our defense of Julian has to be a broad one. Obviously, in the American court, if he gets there, he'll be faced with specific charges. But the real reason for the extradition is that he's a bad example. And they want to nip these things in the bud to frighten people, saying, don't do it. If you do it, remember what we did to Assange. To come to your question, I haven't been inside the prison. No, I last met Julian just before he went to prison. And I asked him the following. I said, is there anything you think that could stop the extradition? I mean, we'll do whatever we can. And he said the only thing that would stop it is a Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn. This might or might not happen, but the election is on the 12th of December, and many members of Jeremy Corbyn's team have defended Julian, and have said that they will look at this issue fresh if they come to power December the 12th. So I think Julian is right. That is the only hope. Interestingly enough, the judge appointed to try Julian for the extradition, Justice Arbuthnot, is herself a well-known security judge, i.e. judges approved by the security services for trying difficult cases. Her husband is well-known in the arms trade. They're totally linked up to various and nefarious enterprises like arms dealing. So they've got a safe judge, the British judicial establishment. So we shouldn't be too surprised by that verdict. The only question is whether we can stop it. If he's tried, that court will come out for extradition.
Proof of Arbuthnot's prejudice is very interesting. Just the other day, she released on bail two people who were accused of murder. There was an extradition aspect to India, and Arbuthnot gave these people bail and freed them, even though they were charged with murder, while on the other hand, Julian, who is not charged with anything violent and only providing information, is held without bail. So that's kind of, you know, really significant in terms of her bias.
Margaret, why did the Obama administration not indict Julian? After all, his administration indicted 8 whistleblowers, and that was more than all prior presidents combined, and now Trump has indicted 8, including Julian.
Julian's situation is different. He is not a hacker. He is not a whistleblower. He is a publisher and a journalist. And this is the first time that a publisher has been charged under the Espionage Act. And I think the Obama administration saw that that wasn't a wise thing to do because that was violative of the First Amendment.
I'd like to ask both of you, what's at stake here? Is it an exaggeration to claim that what's at stake is the future of investigative journalism?
There's no question that the future of investigative journalism is at stake. If a journalist cannot seek out information, a journalist cannot function. A journalist is an investigator. And what this accusation is that you can't be an investigator. You can't even receive this information without doing anything. Just the mere publishing of it and the mere conversation about it with the whistleblower is sufficient to charge you with espionage violations, which is outrageous. And if you're a journalist and this is what your future is about, then you're really in trouble. And also the future of the liberty of this country is at stake, because if we can't reveal what the powerful people in this country are carrying on, then we have no control, and there's no way of stopping this, and we just head on to fascism.
I think that controlling investigative journalism has been a central project of governments for the last 20 years, and they've more or less been successful. I mean, The Guardian and The New York Times and others publishing WikiLeaks and then publishing Edward Snowden's revelations is not work that they had done themselves, because in most cases, including to a certain extent in the liberal press, there is no Department for Special Investigations anymore. Occasionally they do it, but rarely. So they themselves have been very dependent on what WikiLeaks and Snowden have done and claimed the credit. I'd be a bit more impressed, in fact, if they were defending Assange with some vigor. In fact, they're not defending him at all. And the news today that the Swedish government has now stopped investigating those charges, which many of us thought at the time were not credible, linked to rape. If the Swedes have now dropped these, it's a sign that what we thought at the time was correct, that he was being set up. And our book in defense of Julian Assange, which is a collection of writings, a number of authors take you through what has been done to Julian systematically. The slander campaigns, the assaults, the legal case, etc., etc. It's a deconstruction job that Margaret and I and others contributing to it have done, and we hope it has some impact, to be honest.
Margaret, can you put Julian's case in the perspective of the historic, recently accelerated decline of the rule of law and democracy back during the Vietnam War? As listeners know, the Supreme Court allowed publication of the Pentagon Papers. Could courts overthrow that precedent?
Well, we would think not, except that the judges in this country have been so changed by this administration that we don't know what to expect. There was a big effort to prevent the Pentagon Papers from coming out. Well, that was no easy task. There was an injunction against the production of those papers. And clearly, those papers, just like the papers that Julian has put out, were protected by the First Amendment. And clearly, I just want to add that the effort to get the Pentagon Papers took the reporters a tremendous amount of effort. It was no easy task. They were involved in getting that material before it was published, much more so than Julian today was involved.
The attorney for the Pentagon Papers, for the New York Times, at the time of the Pentagon Papers, was James Goodale. And he has commented on the book in defense of Julian Assange. The charge against Assange for conspiring with a source is the most dangerous I can think of with respect to the First Amendment in all my years representing media organizations. That's some heavy stuff. Tariq, let me ask you this. And Margaret, I'd like you to comment on this as well. Would you say that ultimately, considering how this case arose, that imperialism is incompatible with the rule of law and democracy?
Well, imperialism always has been like that. But what we're witnessing now is capitalism in its homelands, in the United States in particular, but also increasingly mimicked by Western Europe, is creating a situation where the mainstream media is largely monolithic. There is very little diversity in what it writes or covers, apart from exceptional things like Donald Trump or Brexit, where there are divisions. By and large, on most affairs, they're in unison and harmony with the government of the day, and this has been getting worse and worse over the last 20 years. So I think that is a huge problem, which we've only managed to sort of fight back because of the internet. But there's now a lot of talk about censoring the internet, which some countries already do, like Iran and China, for instance. Then why shouldn't the Western governments do the same thing? So there's a permanent attempt now taking place to institutionalize censorship and to not just monopolize information, but release it only when it's safe.
Margaret, did you want to add to that?
Yes, you know, I would like to read just a paragraph from the book. It's a paragraph by Margaret Kimberly, and I think that some of these essays are fantastic, and I'm so pleased with them. Margaret Kimberly's is a beautiful essay, and I just want to read one paragraph from it. What little is left of American democracy depends upon the existence of a free and independent press. Julian Assange must be defended for that reason. He must be defended precisely because the ruling elites want to lock him up. His willingness to show us what war looks like or how trade agreements deprive millions of people of their rights make him an ally, not just as a person, but as an ally of the principles of Americans' claim to what they care about.
What kind of support is Julian getting in Great Britain and in the USA? Tariq, could you first talk about Britain?
Well, it's a campaign largely led by activists. You know, we are doing things, but it doesn't have any support within the media at all. It is not covered by any television network. The liberal press ignore us. The right-wing press want Assange to be extradited and threatened, including the top end of the right-wing media like The Economist. So it is really very much a minority campaign, but, you know, led by and participated in by good people, John Pilcher, Jeffrey Robertson, many people who contribute to our book. We've had a number of demonstrations in favor of Assange, one outside the prison, one outside the British Home Office, and the one outside the Home Office was larger, Roger Waters, Fang, and that was very popular. Julian's father came and spoke, but we operate in a very difficult environment as far as Julian is concerned, because the rape allegations alienated lots of young people from him. completely, you know, I mean, it was very carefully and deliberately organized and orchestrated. So this book is part of building up some support for him again, and hopefully people who read it will realize what's at stake. But we do what can be done within the limits.
And Margaret, on the United States?
Well, I think it's quite similar to Britain, but I think that we're beginning to have a slight change in terms of journalists in this country beginning to understand the threat that this poses to them. And just, I think that where we are going to be first successful and will perhaps lead to a greater movement in this country will be the national security journalists who will reach out and talk about this in the public, in the media, in the mass media, because right now Julian does not reach the mass media. He's on Twitter, but he doesn't get beyond that. So I think once this information can get out, and probably and hopefully through these journalists, then we'll have a basis of support that we can build on.
We're talking about the book In Defense of Julian Assange, just came out, orbooks.com is how you can get it. Julian wrote a letter to Gordon Dimmack from his prison cell in London on May 13th of this year. Julian wrote, "I'm unbroken, albeit literally surrounded by murderers. But the days when I could read and speak and organize to defend myself, my ideas and my people are over until I am free. Everyone else must take my place. I am defenseless, and I am counting on you and others of good character to save my life. Truth ultimately is all we have." Margaret, Tariq, what can we do to help Julian?
Well, I think beginning to get support for him is going to be very helpful. And beginning to explain to people and let them understand that the character assassination that has gone on against him really was to distract from what the government was doing. It was not, it really, the way it proceeded and the way it blew up and the way it happened was not a normal hatred that developed. People just don't hate on that level simply because someone does something that they don't like. So it was definitely government orchestrated. And I think that this book will help explain to people that it was more of a distraction to take away from the reality of what the situation is and how important Julian's work is.
I agree strongly with that. No point in repeating it.
With that, I want to urge people, go to orbooks.com and get In Defense of Julian Assange. It's a marvelous book. The two of you are to be thanked profoundly for your good work in putting it together and for the brilliant introduction that you wrote. Tariq Ali, Margaret Kunstler, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.